call the meeting to order. This is Senate and Labor Commerce Committee. This is Thursday, April 2nd, 2009. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum present. Here with me are Senator Thomas to my right, Senator Davis to my left. My name is Senator Pascvan. I understand Senator Kevin Meyer is in a meeting, but will be soon with us, and I believe Senator Bundy is in the hallway, probably stepping in the next moment or so. The first purpose of our meeting today is to hear an overview of the Nanana Basin Gas Exploration Project, and we will receive that by Jim Mary of Doyon Limited and Mr. Jim Dodson of Rampart Energy. And this project has tremendous implications both for labor and commerce issues in the state of Alaska, and I look forward to hearing from them. I want to make sure we all understand that I also intend to take up the following legislation today after the Nanana Basin presentation: Senate Bill 159 relating to workers' comp funeral expenses, and then lastly, Senate Bill 163 relating to the maximum benefit from the Fisherman's Fund. As to those two bills, it is my intent to hear and move both of those bills from this committee today. So that is our agenda in a nutshell. Thank you all for joining us today. We'll begin by welcoming Mr. Jim Mary from Doyon Limited. He is on my right, and to the left, Mr. James Dodson of Rampart Energy Company out of Colorado. And I guess would turn this over to Mr. Mary to kind of give us an outline of the presentation. And again, that Senator Bundy is joining us now.
Well, Senator, thank you and the rest of the committee for allowing us to come down here and give a presentation on this project that we're very excited about, and we think could have very large implications, positive ones, for not just the interior, but other parts of the state as well. And so with that, I'll begin the presentation. A quick overview. Basically, our group is, and I'll talk about who they are in a moment, we're looking at a half a million acre contiguous land package, really just due west of Nanana and due west of the Parks Highway. Primarily the lands, it's mostly state of Alaska lands. Some mental health trust lands, some Doyon Limited lands, which we share with the Village Corporation of Togatili, that represents Nanana, and university lands, although the university land situation, I think, is a big question mark in light of a recent Supreme Court decision in the last couple of weeks as far as their land entitlement. So that those lands would just remain with the state of Alaska. Our group in the past, we spent about $5 million collecting seismic and doing other studies. We believe the basin has gas potential from 1 to 6 TCF of gas. That's trillion cubic feet. And just as a frame of reference, we put on the slide up here that Cook Inlet has produced about 7 TCF of gas since the early 60s. So it could be a very significant resource. There is some oil possibilities. There was some oil interest from majors back in the 80s, never developed into much. But we're going to be drilling a 10,500-foot well, maybe 11,000 feet this summer. Only 4 miles from the town of Nanana on mental health trust lands. Actually, on most of it is we will be using an existing right-of-way, improved right-of-way that's already there. And it's very close to infrastructure, Parks Highway, Alaska Railroad, the interties that connect Anchorage and Fairbanks. And so it would actually lend itself to very rapid development where we'd have success because we're so close to infrastructure. And what we're going to focus on in particular later in the presentation are the job opportunities that are being created right now as we speak, all through the summer, and then if we have success, what to expect in coming years. So with that, I'll talk about who the investors are in the project. Doyon Limited is one of, it's an Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act company. It's a company that I've been proudly associated with for over 25 years. It's a company, we are the largest private landowner in the state. We basically last year we did about $150 million in business, profits of about $16 million. Very active in oil field contracting, drilling, catering, security, engineering, construction. We do some government contracting work, and we also do some, we have a little tourism business in Denali National Park. Our other partners, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation is another large ANCSA corporation out of Barrow and Anchorage. They're an active investor in this project, as is Usabelli Energy, which is an affiliate of the Usabelli coal mine family. Our other partner is Rampart Energy, and I'm going to turn this over to Jim Dodson to talk a little bit about his company in Denver.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Rampart Energy Company was formerly known as Babcock & Brown Energy. It was formed in 1990. It's a privately held oil and gas exploration and production company. We have oil and gas production operations in five states.
If I could interject for 1 minute, I see Representative Ramirez. Jay?
He's talking to himself.
Would you like to come up and... Okay. No, conveying the opportunity if you'd like to come up. But anyways, sorry, I just wanted...
So when Doyon last year acquired all of the rights to the Nanana Basin Exploration Project exclusively unto Doyon and the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation and Usabelli Energy Group, he called me and asked me if we were interested in coming into the project, and we're very excited about it. We're excited about the idea that we're going to be drilling out there in about 2 months. So if we can move on to the graphic. I'd like to just orient you a bit on where exactly the Nanana Basin Exploration Area is located. If you could look at the map here, you can see that the block sits basically west of the town of Nanana. The Nunavak number one is our first location, which we'll be drilling in June, we expect. That's about 4 or 4.5 miles west of the town of Nanana. To give you some idea and perspective, if you look at the southern boundary of the block and go all the way to the northern boundary of the block, it's about 45 miles. And then across the block is somewhere from 15 to 25 miles, depending on where you look at it. But it's over an 800 square mile block. The largest single part of it comes from a state of Alaska exploration license issued in 2002 for about 490,000 acres. Then there's Alaska Mental Health Trust lands, as well as Doyon lands in the exploration block. As you can see, we've got good pipeline or right-of-way access via the Parks Highway from the Nanana exploration block into the town of Fairbanks. And I'd also like to draw your attention to the two electrical interties running out of Fairbanks toward Anchorage, because those also offer a near-term potential gas market in the form of gas used for power production, so that the proximity of the electrical interties is very useful to us as well. And going on to the next slide, as Jim Mary mentioned, we're looking at drilling a 10,500-foot exploratory well this summer. It will be manned by Doyon Drilling using their Arctic Wolf rig. We've already pre-positioned equipment across the river. Our building trail basically have temporary bridges pre-positioned, ready to swing into place across some of the streams we still need to cross. But we anticipate ferrying the drilling rig across sometime in May into early June and move it out to location and begin drilling with it. That will, of course, require personnel camps, which are being provided to us through Black Gold and Taiga Ventures. We've also got quite a bit of civil work already underway by Bryce and Arctic Construction. A lot of activity already took place this past winter and is ongoing right now in anticipation of summer access with the drilling rig and commencement of drilling operations.
Thank you. Let the record reflect Senator Terrio from North Pole has joined the presentation, so we welcome him.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
We'll give you some ideas to what we're thinking in terms of employment for this year. Somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 to 120 jobs at varying stages of the project. Through road construction, we anticipate about 30 jobs, about 25 additional jobs hauling the rig from the North Slope and back to the North Slope later in the year. And then for somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 8, maybe as many as 10 or 12 weeks, we expect we'll have a drilling rig and crew out there providing somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 80 jobs. So, and then of course there's ancillary support personnel such as catering, housekeeping, road maintenance, So we're looking at, you know, north of 100 jobs just starting out this year. So if you wanted to go ahead. Okay. And then looking at the prospect on more of a micro level, we put up a graphic here to give you some idea of what sort of size we're looking at. That area that's inside of the red envelope is about 2,000 acres. And the lines that you see out there, for example, with the number 5 in the center, that delineates a square mile. Okay. So when we look at that size structure and we start filling it with natural gas in our model, the problem, of course, is you don't know exactly where you start filling it with natural gas from. Maybe it's full from the top to the bottom, maybe part of it's full, we don't know. But just given the size of prospect that is, and anticipating some reasonable porosities to the rock, we could have any result from an absolute dry hole to as much as 200 BCF in that one 2,000 acre prospect that we'll be drilling this summer. So what I'd like to convey to you with that is, you know, we're just starting out now on, you know, 500,000 acre plus size block with a 2,000 acre prospect. So we could potentially, in this one prospect, have anywhere from no gas to 200 BCF of gas, with a median case and our expectation of 60 BCF of gas. And just moving on to the Arctic Wolf.
This is just a picture of the drilling rig that will be used. It's one of the smaller rigs in the Doyon fleet of 7 rigs. It's used for just specifically these types of operations, exploration drilling in more remote parts of the state.
Mr. Mary, if it be okay, Senator Terrio has a question that he would request at the time, and I don't know if you have a preference on getting through it or Senator Terrio.
Yeah, I'm just curious on the 2,000 acre and what you think might be the upper end of the gas that you'd hope to find there. What kind of delineation, or you're not going to put a pipe in and voila, you have all that gas. So we're always frustrated, and so are the constituents, that it takes so long to sort of prove up the resource. If in fact you found gas in a quantity that you thought you had something, what would be the steps and the time that it would take to sort of delineate?
We're going to get to that. We can jump forward or just you know, we have that graphed out for you.
Okay.
A quick answer would really be in the 2013 range. We anticipate that we, by that point in time, we would have enough reserves and gas deliverability proven up, obviously in a success case, to justify building a pipeline into Fairbanks. Shorter term than that, we anticipate that we could begin generating power near the intertie and sell electricity into the intertie from natural gas-fired generators.
Thank you.
Access, we mentioned this a bit ago, and we are so close to so many things, that Parks Highway, the Alaska Railroad System, major power transmission systems, both for terms of kind of right-of-way for access to bring pipeline into Fairbanks, for instance, but again, access for power generation as well. And it's just because we don't have to build a lot of road to get, and we don't have to go through a lot of federal land, no federal parks, no federal wildlife refuges, those sorts of things. It just makes it a lot easier to develop this thing very quickly if we do have early success.
Mm-hmm. Let the record reflect, we've been joined by Senator Meyer.
Our core target market has always been bringing pipeline gas to Fairbanks in the North Pole area. And I mentioned North Pole in particular because what you see in the next bullet really talks about power generation refineries. Really a critical element to making gas a reality of economic, really, from a place like Nenana, is you need some industrial users. And so the power generation by Golden Valley and their North Pole facilities, as well as potential use by the refineries in North Pole as well, are really an essential piece of making a project like this successful. But pretty much everything is on distillates, in large measure in Fairbanks today. 10 to 15 BCF of gas a year is really the market, and those are the components, heating, power generation, refineries. And generally, just scoping this, you need about a 15 or 20 year supply of gas at, let's say, 10 BCF a year to justify a private sector pipeline. So 150 to 200 BCF a year is really, 150 to 200 BCF total is really the resource that we would need. And as you, just to reflect back on the slide that Jim talked about earlier, you know, the upper end of this one prospect could be as much as 200 BCF. And so, you know, that's sort of swinging for the fences with the first hole in the ground, but it's not inconceivable that we get very close to being right at what we would need to justify a pipeline. Other markets. There are other things that Jim referenced a bit ago, power generation at Nenana. Fairbanks today imports between 40 and 70 megawatts of power each day. It's increasingly more expensive, and frankly, it's not as reliable as it used to be. You know, Tai again is close by, and there's available space. Power could go north and south. More could go south if the Intertie was upgraded, and you might want to come talk to some people about that down here at some point. But you don't need very much gas actually for that, 4 BCF a year, and so you know 50-60 BCF of gas. If we found that, I think we could be in the power business very, very quickly. Had a lot of advanced discussions with Golden Valley about that. We like the power generation. It's kind of a minimal success case for us. Pipeline to South Central. Now, this is the kind of the blue sky case, and well, I guess waving your arms a little bit. But as you all are very well aware, increasing shortages are in the Anchorage South Central area will be severe. And depending on who you talk to, that's the range, 70 to 30 BCF a year by 2015 and beyond. And it gets worse. So could Nenana be an alternative to the Bullet Line from the North Slope, Foothills, or elsewhere? Obviously, we'd need a much larger reserve base, but it should be much less than the 2 to 3 TCF that's knocked around as far as what's needed for a Bullet Line all the way from the North Slope. We don't view the Nenana Basin as necessarily being a long-term solution for South Central, but it could very well be a good medium-term, short-term solution as a bridge almost to when the big pipeline comes through for export gas, the Lower 48. And we just see that as a real possibility. And clearly what we think is going on in the basin may, there could be enough gas, and we could find enough gas in the next 3 to 4 years to actually help with that situation. It's not a focus today, but depending on what we find, if we find a lot of gas, our attention could change pretty quickly. And we have had a lot of discussions with NSTAR about that. They're very interested in our project. Other markets. Through work that was done by ARCO a number of years ago, there's a real possibility of some propane in the gas stream. In particular, we at Doyon like this a lot because this is at Nenana. And apart from delivery of propanes into the rail belt, Nenana is the hub of barge distribution to the entire Yukon-Kaikuk River drainage system. There are a lot of communities out there that are part of Doyon, and if there's an opportunity to deliver, give an alternative fuel source to those communities, that hopefully that would be less expensive and a little more environmentally sound than moving a lot of diesel. We like that a lot. It's something we were also looking at. And I'm going to turn it back over to Jim, and this will address some of your questions, the questions that Senator Terrio had.
Thanks. What we've laid out here is a generalized timeline of what we anticipate for the continuation of the exploration part of this project, and then, assuming a success case, the entry into a development phase, and then ultimately selling gas into Fairbanks. And giving you a rough estimate of our timelines. As you can see, back in 2005, about a $4.5 million seismic program was generated in 2005. Frankly, the project slowed down a bit after that because of some production tax issues that the legislature has, in fact, resolved and resolved to the point where my company, Rampart Energy Company, has come into the project. So right now we're in the exploration and delineation drilling phase that you see in 2009. We anticipate we'll be drilling in June of 2009, June of this year. Assuming success in that project this summer, which could mean as little as finding gas but not in a trapped position, finding that we have an active petroleum system, we would be encouraged to continue additional exploration in the basin to look for additional gas in a trapped position. And that would entail most likely some additional seismic work in the winter of 2009-2010. Both a 2D survey to the north, on the north end of the block where we have no seismic coverage and where we believe the basin, based on aeromagnetic data, is deeper, which may mean it's more likely to generate hydrocarbons, and also a 3D survey in and around whatever discovery we may have or whatever indications of hydrocarbon accumulation we may have this
summer. If I could interject, possibly define the terms 2D and 3D
really a function of the quantity of data that you gather. 2D lines are relatively largely spaced, as much as a mile, on more of a reconnaissance basis. And 3D seismic is typically run with a seismic line, say, on every 110 feet, 110-foot bin sizes, we call them, where you gather a great deal more data such that you can, with the use of computers and software, develop a very complex 3D model of the basin versus, it's the difference between just looking at a piece of cake and picking a piece of cake up and turning it around in your hand, basically. So the 3D is it's typically more of a developmental tool. Once you have indications that you have gas, you can spend a great deal more money on seismic, trying to nail down exactly where you want to put your next well or wells. And then, assuming we go into a full-fledged development scenario, somewhere in the 2011 to 2012 timeframe, we could potentially have proven up enough reserves in 2013 or so to then build a pipeline into Fairbanks. Now, if we're drilling and we're having success and we're building reserves and we're delivering, and our deliverability, our ability on a daily basis to deliver gas is rising, we would enter into the permitting phase for pipeline rights of way and to build a pipeline into Fairbanks, with the idea that, given where we are on the development curve, we should anticipate enough success to go ahead and build the pipeline. If for some reason we come up short, even though we're having some success, we come up short of the reserves we need to build the pipeline, at least we would not at that point have spent the money on the pipeline, but we would have spent the money on the permitting. But if we are ready to go forward, we've already done the permitting and can put the capital into the pipeline. So moving on to the next. So we anticipate on the 2D and 3D surveys in the winter of 2010 that we would use somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 75 people. Contractors in Alaska that we could use would be folks like PGS Onshore, CGG Veritas, and then of course we'd need additional camp services, surveyors, construction, some maintenance work, etc. But we anticipate that would be about 50 to 75 jobs next winter. And then in the next phase of the project, which would be the exploration, development, drilling, the number of people we would need for this would really be a function of how many rigs we had out there. But assuming that we had at least one rig working, we're looking at probably 110 to 120 people helping us with the developmental drilling project, which we would anticipate would start as early as potentially winter of 2011, more likely 2012, but potentially as early as 2011, depending on success. And then moving on to facilities construction, this would be things like pipelining, processing facilities, things like that. Between the actual, between the construction of the processing facilities and the ancillary help from folks in catering, etc., we would anticipate 90 to 180 jobs would be created.
One of the questions that's always comes up is, are these going to be jobs for Alaskans as compared to jobs from somewhere else? And what are your thoughts, either Mr. Marrier
or than I?
Well, let's just talk about this summer. Let's talk about right now. Right now, it's 100% Alaska hire on the job. There are 32 jobs. Of those 32 jobs, I think 80% of them were just from the Nenana area itself. 100% was Nenana Fairbanks area. We'll point out that about half of those jobs were Alaska Native, actually, Enjoyan shareholders. And as we move forward into the summer, certainly on the drill rig, we I've been assured it's going to be 100% Alaska hire on the Doyon drill rigs this summer, and those operations usually some run between 35% and 40% of those are Alaska Native Doyon shareholders on the Doyon rigs. So the ancillary services, we see no reason why any of that stuff this summer would be anything other than Alaska hire. As we move out into the next several years, the type of work that we see, further drilling, the seismic crews, most of those things are generally Alaska hire, best as we can see.
We would certainly not look to bring anyone in from outside the state. I mean, right now, to this point in the project, we've certainly found that people in Alaska can do everything that this project requires. With regard to pipeline construction, there are multiple engineering firms who could really help us out on pipeline construction, from ASRC, CH2M Hill, Doyon. We anticipate that would be at least 50 to as many as 80, possibly as many as 100 people for pipeline construction to design and procure and construct a pipeline from the Nanana Basin into Fairbanks. And that estimate may be low. In the middle of trenching and welding, et cetera, that number is really likely to grow.
You know, we've heard large diameter, bullet line. You know, what size line are you estimating this feeder line from your site into Fairbanks? What's the range of
basically, if the project is really just meant to service Fairbanks as opposed to maybe part of a spur line later on, but just as a Fairbanks line, it would probably be a 12-inch line, and the cost estimates that we have on that, it's about $110 million to take it all the way to North Pole. As I mentioned earlier, we really need to go to North Pole because that's where the industrial users are. So with obviously stop-offs, so to speak, and in Fairbanks as well. But about $110 million today. Okay, when we move into production, obviously this is a hope for a 30 to 50 year life on a project like this. And again, there's a number of functions that need to take place, both as we already actually just on the day-to-day operations. And so basically this is the spread of work that you might anticipate: supervisors, operators, roustabouts, road maintenance, lots of other trades involved. And depending again on the size of this, somewhere between 45 and 100 people. Some of that could be in Fairbanks, a lot of it actually would have to be in Nanana. That's basically something from a smaller project to something quite large, and that would even, it could be actually a little bit larger if we were so fortunate as to find some oil, which is certainly not beyond the pale of possibilities in this basin.
If you could expand on that as far as when you say if we might find some oil, what's the history of this resource in this area? So
there was back in the 80s, there was a state oil and gas lease sale. Numerous leases were indeed taken by major oil companies looking for, and they were going to look for oil. And there were some seismic was shot in the early 80s. Actually, ARCO drilled a stratigraphic test on the southern end of the basin just to take a look at what the rocks might be like. And their focus was not gas. There was plenty of gas on the North Slope. There was plenty of gas in Cook Inlet at that time. And the Fairbanks market was certainly not anything large enough to attract the larger oil and gas companies for gas. So it was an oil play. We've seen that data. We've actually licensed all of that data. We've also done analog studies, similar basins, other places in the world. And what we find out is these are all very gassy basins, and some of those basins have significant oil production associated with them as well. So we're still encouraged that there very well may be an oil component to the Nanana Basin.
You've indicated earlier that this drill is going to go to 10,500 feet. What was the prior depth of drilling, and what is the reason for?
Mr. Chairman, it was approximately 3,000 feet was the deepest penetration previously in the basin, and that was the Arco Totec Hills well to the south, actually off the block. It was so far south, and it only encountered about 3,000 feet of sediment before it hit the basement. And we're really focused now on the deepest core area of the basin, up against the basin bounding faults on the east side, just west of the town of Nanana. So.
And the Totec Hills wells, clearly there were gas shows in that well, even at those shallow depths, and the geochemistry, the cuttings, that gives us some encouragement about the propane possibilities of the basin as well.
Speaking of the chemistry of this site, is there a comparison in the chemistry or the geology of this site as compared to Cook Inlet? You know, earlier you were saying Cook Inlet is since the 1960s has produced about 7 TCF. What's the geology comparisons, if any, between?
Actually, they're very correlatable stratigraphically and in terms of age. They're both tertiary age, interior, lacustrine, non-marine, non-ocean basins. There's a marine component in the bottom of the Cook Inlet, but predominantly that is a terrestrial land-bound basin, as is the Nanana Basin. I would say, I think it's important to note that the 9 to 10 TCF of natural gas reserves known in the Cook Inlet are predominantly what we would call biogenic gas. They're from microbial action, basically digesting coals in that are infused with fresh water, meteoric waters, and then releasing methane as an end product of biological digestion, basically, of the coals. And our model here is based on thermogenic generation of natural gas, which is burying coals, burying shales deeply enough to cause thermochemical reactions to occur that then generate natural gas and release it. So my point is, we really haven't even tried to quantify what the biogenic resource potential of the Nanana Basin is, because we really can't. So I would say that they're stratigraphically equivalent. We have biogenic potential in the Nanana Basin as well, but what its size is, we really don't know. I would say the Cook Inlet Basin is 3 times the size of this one, so if that one's going to produce 9, then we might produce 3 TCF of gas. I mean, we're at that point on the exploration curve. I can't give you a more definitive answer than that.
We mentioned power generation, and so this is a spread of jobs that you might anticipate were we to move into that phase. And this is based on 40 to 70 megawatts of simple cycle base load power. And there's a construction phase that would probably take about 18 months. And up to 180 jobs would, folks would be working on that project at different times during that 18 months. And then as we move into operations, up to around 17 jobs, that would probably all be located right there in Nanana. Great infusion into a small community like that to have 17 good paying jobs. That's pretty much what that spread looks like. We always finish with this, and irritates a few people. Wood bison reintroduction, we've talked to some of you about this before. Wood bison is an endangered species under federal law. Fish and Game wants to stick them right in the middle of where we want to explore. We don't think that's a very good idea. We'd like to work with Fish and Game, and actually are working with them to locate other more suitable places in the state, including some Doyon lands in the western part of the state that are just not in conflict with pending development projects. And certainly we would support some congressional action that would just really remove them from ESA jurisdiction, and we probably wouldn't have the objection even to the Nanana Basin. But that's probably not going to happen, but it certainly is an option. The second thing is, I think this is maybe not an issue or as much of an issue as it may have been earlier in the session. There was the notion that Fairbanks Natural Gas was going to attempt to get some special legislation here in Juneau that would pre-authorize ADA to basically bond and own $250 million worth of facilities for them to truck gas down from the North Slope. And basically I guess our position on that today is just simply ADA just needs to, they just need to go to ADA. ADA needs to do their due diligence process. And we think the current public policy, which would mean if ADA wants to advance that project, they can come back to the legislature next year and we'll have a fuller discussion about what's the best use of state funds. And we'll also have a lot more information for people, including results from our wells and other information related to other projects, such as the bullet line from the North Slope. So that's, I guess we're just simply asking that folks not impair or preempt other private sector efforts such as ourselves right now. And I guess just in summary, what we think we have is the possibility of a very large gas resource in the Nana Basin, maybe oil, although a large gas resource is not needed for several types of viable Fairbanks projects. Infrastructure and access would allow us to move quickly to development. Power generation by 2012, pipeline gas to Fairbanks, again, harder to predict, but 2014 is kind of our target. Could go either way, a little faster or a lot slower, I guess. And gas for South Central is certainly not beyond the realm of possibilities. And as you saw from the different job spreads in different phases, there are a lot of jobs out there and job training opportunities for Alaskans. And I think that's our presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Murray. Mr. Dodson, certainly would open it up for questions. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the presentation, Jim. Jim, depending on the first well that's drilled, what you have rather high expectations, I guess, and how you pick the spot that you think is a prime spot. If it's a dry well, what does that do versus if it has some indications? Obviously, you move forward, but what if it's just a dry well? Is that the end of things, or what's the thinking? Probably might have to think that through at that point, but I'm saying just now because we have so many things up in the air here now that obviously we're looking to move forward, bullet lines, this or that or whatever. So,
Senator Thomas, through the chair, I would say it would be very disappointing to have a completely dry well. We would certainly go back and relook at our seismic data, particularly in light of sonic logs that we would gather from the well we drilled this summer, which gives us a much better idea of the velocities or the speed at which sound travels through those individual rocks. And if we thereby reinterpret our existing seismic data and realize, oh, okay, some of our velocity assumptions were wrong, and get a completely different picture of the basin architecture and realize that, you know, we were drilling in a breached structure or we really weren't in a trapping position and thought we were, but could then map a trapping position, we would probably still be encouraged to go try another well in what we could then see was a better position. I would say for this first well, a success case wouldn't necessarily be finding producible gas reserves. Finding that we have an active petroleum system, meaning oil and or natural gas being generated, would be a significant success in this first well. So I would say that one dry hole does not condemn the project, nor does one producing well prove up the project. It's going to take a longer period of time to decide either way on the project, either a full-fledged go to development decision or a decision that we simply need to walk away.
And with that thought in mind, if I may, so you drilled the first well and then you were not planning on drilling the second one the same season, right? Is that my understanding? Unless something caused you to say, wow, we need to drill this other
one. That's correct. We had for a time entertained the thought of permitting the second well. But what we realized was that we would not be giving ourselves the benefit of what we learned this summer to then go drill a second well this year. You know, we're talking about $15 million wells here. And maybe the second one is $10 million because so much of the infrastructure cost has been covered. But we really want to learn something from the first well before we try and drill the second.
That's good for now. Thank you.
you know, what's a within the realm of reasonable expectations, how many wells would have to be drilled to prove up the field? You know, that I think that's ultimately maybe what Senator Thomas was.
Getting to the point where you have enough reserves and maybe even more importantly deliverability, which is your ability to on a daily basis hand gas off to a market, is a function of rock properties. It's a function of porosity and even more importantly permeability. And unless and until we recover a core from reservoir rock and can test that for its permeability, and we also have a well into a reservoir and can do a pressure drawdown on it, which is to say we would flare some gas for say 30 days and see what that does to the deliverability and to the pressure in the reservoir, we wouldn't really be in a position to go to a development scenario. But assuming that you could get say 6 million cubic feet a day out of a well, it's not beyond the realm of reason that you could, and you had say 7 of those, so you start off with maybe 40 million a day of deliverability, but you know it's going to decline, but you only need somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 million cubic feet a day to serve Fairbanks or less. I think it's reasonable to say that 7 successful wells would likely put you in a position to build a pipeline. And I'm saying, you know, 6 million cubic foot per day gas well is a very nice gas well. But given the capital costs associated with these wells, in order for them to be considered economic successes, they really need to have that sort of deliverability to them. So I'm going to say 7 wells successfully drilled would likely be sufficient to prove up reserves and deliverability that would allow us to build a pipeline.
Any other questions? Senator Meyer.
Thank you. Yes, just to follow up on the 7 wells you're talking about, what is a cost per well?
Well, this first well is of course really being done on somewhat of a retail basis. I mean, it's a one-time project right now. So this first well will be right in the neighborhood of a $15 million project. So between this well and the seismic shot in 2005, this is, as of this year, will be about a $20 million project. If we get to a development scenario, I'm confident that well costs could be driven well below $10 million each. Once you get into multiple wells drilling, say, in the winter, and you're keeping your rig busy for 2 or 3 wells back to back, and you're only mobbing and demobilizing the rig once for 3 wells, a lot of your one-time costs get spread over more wells. You gain tremendous cost savings and efficiencies by doing that, and I think the well costs would fall below $10 million.
Yeah, for me.
Yes.
I think some people may think that since you have a relatively shallow well there, 3,000 feet, that it should be, you know, shouldn't be very expensive, but the biggest cost is probably the mob and demob.
Well, the 3,000 foot well we were referencing was a well drilled. It was a stratigraphic test by ARCO,
okay,
called the Totec Hills well back in the early 1980s. Our well is designed to go to 10,500
okay.
feet.
Okay.
And actually, because we are the first deep well in this basin, we're drilling the first deep well in this basin, we have things like a 10,000 pound blowout preventer in our drilling program for this year. We may not need that ultimately, but out of an abundance of caution, we've gone with a very heavy blowout preventer for this well. We've got a very aggressive casing program where we may not, once we know what zones are productive, we may not have to case so much of our well as we're drilling as we are with this first one. So this well is being drilled somewhat differently from what a development well might look like.
Okay, very good. If I could.
Yes, Senator Meyer.
You brought up the ARCO well, and obviously you have bought all the proprietary information on that well, or was that just seismic that you bought from ARCO?
Actually, we licensed. Actually, the seismic was not available for license because it was a group shoot, but all of the internal ARCO information we have licensed a number of years ago. That's correct. Yeah.
So
the well data, yeah, we have all the well data.
Okay. Now, I don't know what you can and can't tell us without having to shoot us, but did they discover anything, any gas?
Yeah, there were gas kicks, and that's actually available from the AOGCC, so okay. I'm not revealing anything proprietary.
Okay. Because you said they were looking for oil.
But they were definitely looking for oil, yes.
Okay, very good. And then the last question, because I don't want this to become the spotted owl for you guys, the wood bison. How can they just say, okay, you guys are now going to take this wood bison? I mean, doesn't whoever owns the land can't you say we don't want wood bison, or how?
Well, the land is actually owned by most of the land in the Nanana Basin is state of Alaska land.
Okay.
And it's land that our group has licensed from the state of Alaska under an exploration license several years ago, and it's Fish and Game. State of Alaska is proposing to put those wood bison out there.
Okay, I thought this was the Native Corporation's land.
No, we're actually, Doyon is an active investor in this project. Very little of the land being explored is on Doyon land.
Is on your own land, okay. If I could follow up?
Certainly.
So what, if anything, can we do to, I know you don't want too much intervention from us, because the less we do, probably the better for you guys. But can we do a resolution or something that says, you know, please don't put the wood bison in this area? Is there already one? Okay. All right. We already done that. When did we do that?
Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, that was introduced a month and a half, 2 months ago. It's in the Resources Committee, and what I had asked Resources to do is perhaps hold some hearings, maybe not ultimately to pass the resolution and say, you know, thou shalt not release them, but maybe through the hearings it would be determined if there's a different area, or at the very least we could get a better understanding and get a public record on what does the Endangered Species Act mean for the state of Alaska. What does it mean in regards to these particular animals? There's the suggestion that there's a 10J exemption that would protect us. Some people say that would protect us. Other people say that that's not going to protect us. But I still believe that we need somewhere in the building to build a public record and perhaps have somebody that has expertise on how the Endangered Species Act actually works come and provide some testimony. But up to this point, I've not been able to get a hearing scheduled on the resolution.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I would agree with that. I mean, with the concern of the polar bear up north and the beluga whale in the Cook Inlet, you know, the last thing we need is now wood bison in the central. So.
Nanana Basin,
yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Bundy.
And I would strongly disagree with that, but and I'm one of those that you will irritate about the wood bison, because Fish and Game have given me strong assurances that that will not be a problem. But I'm in agreement with Senator Terrio. There should be some hearings on this, and a month and a half was probably long enough to wait to have someone move something sometime. But I have a question, actually, after my sermon. You talked about building roads, and this is state land. What kind of environmental impact statement do you have to deal with?
The road building that we are in the process of doing right now is actually all on mental health trust lands. The location for the well is probably about a quarter of a mile from state lands. And most of this access route actually is along an existing right-of-way that's had some prior improvement to it, mostly as a winter trail, access to subsistence and recreation areas out in the flats, you know, to the west of Nanana. So there actually is, in our view, very little additional or new impact. You know, we're just sort of improving some of the current access that's out there. Obviously, if we have a discovery, there would be future improvements. We actually have to go across the Nanana River in a barge and ferry system. Representative Coghill has actually had discussions going with DOT long before we showed up with our project about a bridge to connect this existing trail across the Nanana River. I think that would maybe move to the forefront, perhaps. There are a couple of small creeks to cross. We have temporary bridges that will cross those creeks for our project right now. There's been an environmental assessment by the Corps of Engineers, and that's in the final throes of being processed. We working with the Corps and others, we've kind of rearranged some of the access to avoid wetlands. I guess that's where we are today.
Thank you.
If I could ask one question is, you know, certainly within your definition of success, you will need to have some type of MCF pricing mechanism that will make this all work. And, you know, that's part of your success. So kind of if as best as you can describe that, and then within your success, what does that success mean to the average Fairbanks? And, what economic activity does that bring to Interior Alaska?
Mr. Chairman, the price at which we can sell gas is really, to a large degree, a function of the lithology of the rock. It's a function of what the reservoir gives us. The point being, if I can drill a well and it can drain, because of the tremendous porosity and permeability of a reservoir, it can drain, let's say, 30 billion cubic feet from one well, okay? That's a completely different cost structure from a situation in which I would have to drill, say, a well to get 5 BCF of gas. Both are in the realm of possibility here. So if I have to drill 6 times as many wells to get the same 30 BCF of gas, my capital costs are 6 times higher. And to say what gas should cost at this point, I really can't say, because we just don't know enough about, well, one, we haven't proven that we've got gas in a trap position, and two, assuming we had it, I don't know what the reservoir properties of that reservoir would be, and I don't know what capital cost it would require me to spend to get that reserve. So,
but if I might add, at the other end of the way you might view this, so is at the end of the day, to sell gas that we might find, it's going to have to be priced substantially lower than what Fairbanksons pay for the BTU equivalent of fuel oil, which is anywhere between $15 and $25 an MMBTU, which is a rough equivalent with an MCF of gas. And so we have to provide that kind of an incentive, because people are going to have to convert. That's going to cost a lot of money. It's going to take a while to amortize that. So whatever the lithology may be, we're still going to have to price this stuff attractively enough to make people want to switch to gas.
Senator Terrio, you.
Thanks. You mentioned the changes that were made in the ACES bill that gave you the same tax structure for in-state use, and how that tipped the economics of your project and made you go ahead. And for the members here in the committee, I want to just give thanks to Senator McGuire, who was very critical at a point in Senate Judiciary. She had made a commitment to former Representative Jim Holmes that she would help with energy issues in Fairbanks, and so she came through at a critical time. In addition, in the ACES bill, all the deductions, credits, whatnot, your activity is eligible for those too. And when you talk about a $20 million spend of risk capital on this first well, can you give us an idea how much of that is being borne by the state treasury?
The state is an active partner in this project, somewhere between 40 and 50% probably.
And I just want to, you also touched on the FNG issue, and I know there was the concern that there was a rumor that somehow they'd be pre-authorized. What's happening right now, and you know, about a month ago, the governor told Representative Kelly and I that she'd asked ADA to start that due diligence process. So I think that standard ADA process is what's playing out.
That's fine.
And so, you know, they're not in for a state buck yet, but you guys are out with your development, and the state treasury is picking up about half of that first well cost, and that's great. I mean, we're just looking for energy for Alaskans.
Any additional questions? I would open it up to Mr. Dodson or Mr. Mary if you had any additional concluding comments that you would like to make.
Other than just to thank you again for the opportunity. It's a project that we're very excited about, and with a little luck this summer, come back and give you some really good results in the fall.
Mm-hmm. Well, it certainly does hold a lot of promise for not only Interior Alaska, but I think the state of Alaska as a whole potentially is looking forward to the results of your June 09 drilling process, and I thank you both for attending and answering the questions, addressing these labor and commerce issues that are very important to the state of Alaska.
One last question.
Senator Terrio?
Mr. Mary, if we were successful in getting a hearing, an informational hearing, to build a record on the Endangered Species Act issues, or if the chairman held an informational hearing, since he doesn't have the resolution in front of him, but still, just to build that record, what would you be looking for specifically as far as any kind of assurance or language that would build a public record that what Senator Bundy has been told about, don't worry, there's not going to be a problem, is really true? What particular phrases, what particular issues? Is it the 10J that we just want to understand that and get assurance that that, in fact, will offer the protection? Or is there something else, another concern that we need to be on the lookout for?
Well, the issue with 10J and anything involving the Endangered Species Act, but even the 10J rule, is it's still subject to litigation. And litigation means expense and it means delays. And it's not that we actually disagree with Fish and Game that in all great likelihood, if you had a 10J non-essential population status categorization, if you had that, that even if there were challenges in the process, there forward, and there could be many opportunities for challenges from non-governmental organizations, you might win any one of or all of those bits of litigation, but the real issue is it's taken time and it's taken a lot of money. And part of what NANANA is all about is really how quickly can we develop a gas resource, not just for Fairbanks, but maybe for South Central. And so why put yourself in a situation where you may be dragged in the courthouse time and time again, and every time you go to the courthouse, you know, are you going to stop? Is there a restraining order or an injunction? Or do we even just want to spend the money if some of our decisions are at risk? And so that's really the concern that we have. A lot of the fundamentals we actually don't disagree with Fish and Game about. It's just who is the risk on of both time and money? It's all on us. It's not on Fish and Game.
Is one of the concepts when it comes to the wood bison is its introduction, for example, in the Yukon Basin as compared to the Nanana Basin? In other words, is that part of...
Same problem. We have an energy project heat up there as well. And but we certainly have encouraged them to look at Western Alaska, which they have identified in their studies in the lower Yukon as being a place that could work very well for wood bison. We actually have a lot of Doyon land in that same area. And we've already told Fish and Game, actually, we're working with them on it to kind of take a harder look at that, and subject to local populations not having objections, that would work fine for us. We don't have any projects teed up out there. And
our greatest concern would be that we're in contractual privity with the state of Alaska, the Alaska Mental Health Trust, and with Doyon for our leases out there and for our exploration license from the state of Alaska. And our concern would be that with the introduction of an endangered species into that basin, you could, in effect, federalize that ground. The state, we fear, would lose control over what happens in that basin if there's an endangered species out there and the area in which we're trying to conduct natural gas development operations is, in one lawsuit or another, deemed to be critical habitat and therefore subject to regulation, suspension of operations under the Endangered Species Act. There's a temporal limit to our oil and gas exploration license. If you delay us, you just hold the ball long enough, time will run out on us. Additionally, if we spend money and we get 2, 3, 4 wells into the project, maybe $40 million into the project, something along those lines, and are then stopped and can't get to the point where we actually have a gas pipeline into Fairbanks, we've spent $40 million for nothing. Okay, so we believe that the introduction of an endangered species into this ground puts a significant risk on our project.
Senator Thomas, you had a question?
Yes, I did. Just it might be helpful for you to explain the nature of the state's participation in the project so people aren't left with the wrong impression. You said 40 to 50% participation. You might want to clarify what that means so people.
there are laws of general application to basically people that are exploring in the more remote parts of the of the state, that there are things called exploration incentive credits.
Right.
And it's a program in which through certain type of work that you do, not all work that you do, but certain types of work that you do in certain parts of the state, that you can generate tax credits that are applicable against production taxes. And none of us really, the ASRC has production taxes to pay. We do have the ability to basically cash those credits out with the state itself, or to sell them, transfer them to other companies that can use them, so we can monetize them. And so those are programs that any number of companies participate in throughout the state on a yearly basis. And we would do the same. But it's worked very well. This project probably wouldn't be happening without it.
Appreciate that's a very accurate explanation of how it works, too. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Thomas. With that, I believe that does conclude the questions. Again, I would thank you, Mr. Dotson, and you, Mr. Mary, for the great overview. I think it does give us a good indication of what you're thinking, and I think that we're all looking forward to the promise proving out, and we look forward to hearing from you a year from now.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
This fall.
This summer.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll take a brief at ease. We'll bring Senate and Labor back to order. We now will bring before this committee Senate Bill 159, and this is a bill dealing with workers' compensation death benefit, and this is a bill that I've presented, and my Chief of Staff, Mr. Jeff Stepp, is here to present this bill, so please identify yourself and begin the presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Stepp, and I am a staffer for Senator Pascavan. Thank you for the opportunity to present Senate Bill number 159. Senate Bill 159 just makes one simple change to statute. If I could please draw your attention to current statute, which is AS 2330215A, which refers to the death benefit. Regarding workers' compensation, obviously, and death in the workplace, and to read from statute if I may. If the injury causes death, the compensation is known as a death benefit and is payable in the following amounts to or for the benefit of the following persons. This bill just addresses section one, that reasonable and necessary funeral expenses are changed to the current level of $5,000 to a more appropriate level of $10,000. And we've received some input and feedback from family members of people who have been killed on the job who make the obvious point that $5,000 simply isn't enough in 2009 to have a proper funeral and burial for a person who's been killed on the workplace. And that is the intent of this bill, and it's really that simple, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Stepp? Senator Bundy.
Yeah. Hopefully this won't have a huge fiscal impact on the workers' comp rates. In the last 4 or 5 years, on average, how many people have been killed on the job and have received the death benefit?
Senator Bundy, from what I understand, and this chart is in your packet, the established cases of workers' comp deaths, fatalities, is on the record here going back the last 10 years. So it's varied from a high of 39 in 2002 to a low of 15 in fiscal year 2006. Last year, 29.
If I might, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, maybe I'm not understanding the chart. On the second half of the chart where they have numbers starting with 77, 10, 11, 3.
Yes, sir.
Were they fatalities, sir?
Through the chair, Mr. Bundy, it's a good question. And I asked the Department of Labor and Workforce Development the exact same thing. If you'll read up a little above where it says fatalities on the second half, these are total files reported, and there are a lot of cases that are reported but are not established by the Workers' Comp Board and paid for.
So if I might, Mr. Chairman, just to, I'm sorry to be slow. So under the column FY99, there were 224 reported. Is that how I would read this chart?
Yes, sir.
Then the number 77, what does that correlate? Is that the number accepted or adjudicated? Or
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Mr. Bundy, Paula or somebody is here from the department, and
okay,
they could probably explain this chart
all
lot
right,
better
thank you.
I asked the first question you did, but I didn't dig as deep as you.
Yeah, okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Stepp? We would, is there someone that can... Ms. Varro. Please identify yourselves and state your affiliation, and if you can, assist us.
For the record, my name is Paula Scavera. I'm the Special Assistant Legislative Liaison, Alaska Department of Labor. And with me is someone who can actually answer the question better than I, and I'll let him put his name in the record.
And for the record, my name is Mike Monagle. I'm a program coordinator for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, Division of Workers' Comp. And I actually put together these reports every year. There are, I guess, through the chair, Senator Mundy, there are two statistics we keep. One is reports or incidents that occur every year, and those are the board files established. So fatalities in FY 99 was 31, and FY 08 was 29.
Mm-hmm.
If you drop down to the bottom of that where it says annual report, total board files reported all years, are the fatality cases that the insurance companies continue to report paying benefits on. We don't, when we talk about a fatality, we're not only talking about funeral costs, we're talking about death benefits being paid to the survivors. So these cases on top were actual fatalities that occurred during that fiscal year. The number on bottom are those fatality cases that the insurance companies continued to pay death benefits on. So that's why the number below is higher.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Does that answer the... Thank you very much. Much appreciated.
As long as Paul is there, I had another question. Just here to make your life simple.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just from the department's point of view, the impact of doubling the, I'm not talking about the philosophy, I just want to know what the fiscal impact of doubling the funeral benefits would be on the workers' comp system.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, we have a zero fiscal note, but the director of workers' comp is here who can maybe expand it to the bigger picture. If you're talking about worker comp rates.
We may. My understanding is it's negligible, but...
Hi. My name is Trina Hikes. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation, and unfortunately, I can't give you any hard figures. I could look that up as to the impact on the premium, but I think one simple way you might address it would be to take the additional $5,000 and multiply it times the number of deaths. That would be the impact on the insurance company. And given that small number, I think it would be negligible, as Senator Pasquin said.
Thank you.
Senator Meyer.
Question on along those lines. Wouldn't it depend on the business or the type of business? You know, if it's obviously fishing and mining and oil, much more dangerous than if... you know, I'm in the ConocoPhillips building working as a file clerk or something.
It would depend on the business because, as you know, in workers' compensation, through the chair, Senator Meyer, the premium is based on the risk associated with that industry times the payroll, and that risk value depends on, obviously, the risk factor within that industry, in a given industry. And that would correspond, obviously, with the riskier industries are the ones generally associated with higher numbers of death.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I know we have Kevin Daugherty off-site. Are you there, Kevin?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chairman.
Please provide your name and, if you could, a brief public testimony so that we can...
the bill. I'd like to first respond to that last question. We do know that, for example, in the year 2000, we had 26 fatalities, people killed on the job, and we can easily do the math here. We're looking at probably 120,000, 130,000, or the system in 2000 cost $226 million. So if you do the quick math, we're well less than 0.001% there. So on the economic impact, I think we're talking negligible. What I would like to address is I think everyone would probably agree with me that when we have a fatality in a family, that we want to have a decent burial and funeral process. And I did fax down through the LIO office, hopefully got to you, information on specific costs to have a funeral both in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and the Valley, the Peninsula, Kenai Peninsula area. If you look at the Fairbanks funeral home, which is provided by that business up there in Fairbanks, did that document get to you, Mr. Chairman?
No.
Okay, I apologize. We sent that about an hour ago to LIO, so hopefully it's there and available. I can read comment, not for too much time. The Fairbanks Funeral Home price list has a traditional funeral followed by a burial cost at $7,940. And you need to add to that the cost of the headstone. And a headstone in Anchorage and probably throughout Alaska seems to run from about 1,400 up to 7,000. So if you took an average of a couple thousand for the headstone, the $10,000 figure is certainly reasonable. So I think this is, again, something that we can provide to the surviving family at barely any economic cost, but yet certainly be clear that we're supporting families in that time of need. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Doherty. Any questions? Seeing none, we'll move to Mr. Tom Bryce. Is he
just here for observing?
Thank you. And I know Linda Hall was here, but questions only, as I understand. So anyone else here or off-site or here locally that would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony on Senate Bill 159. Any further discussion necessary by the members of this committee? Senator Thomas, I'd...
Will of the body? I move that Senate Bill 159, version / R, be moved to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. We'll take a brief at ease for purposes of signing. Bring the Labor and Commerce Committee back to order. We now have before us Senate Bill 163, also from my office, we bring Mr. Jake Hamburg forward to present this bill. And Mr. Hamburg, please identify yourself and begin your presentation.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Jake Hamburg, staff to Senator Pasquin. Before you, you have Senate Bill 163, which updates the Alaska Fisherman's Fund limit to $10,000. This will bring the program back to providing a meaningful level of assistance as the payer of last resort for commercial fishermen and crew that sustain injuries while fishing. To give you some background, the Alaska Fisherman's Fund was established in 1951. It was set up to provide for the treatment and care of Alaska licensed commercial fishermen and crew who are injured while fishing onshore or offshore. The upper limit on claims in the fund has remained $2,500 since 1959. If this $2,500 in 1959 had been adjusted for the Consumer Price Index, it would be worth approximately $18,229 today. While the upper limit on claims has remained unchanged, healthcare costs have steadily risen, and the fund is financed from revenue received from each resident and non-resident commercial fisherman's license and permit fee. In 2008, there were 13,706 commercial fishing permit holders who contributed to the fund, including 135 from the Fairbanks North Star Borough. The account has grown to $11.5 million, even as healthcare costs have risen, due in part to continuing improvements in fishing industry safety. SB 163 updates the Alaska Fisherman's Fund to $10,000 to help ensure that Alaska's fishermen have access to health care when injured while fishing. And this increase is not projected to jeopardize the sustainability of the fund. Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to answer any questions you or the committee may have.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. I'm just wondering on proportionality here. The
sure.
Previous bill raised the average funeral expense was around $10,000-$12,000 and raised the rate to $10,000. You're saying that it would be north of $18,000 if we had been adjusted for inflation, but you're only adjusting it up to $10,000. I'm just wondering why the disparity. Why not adjust it up to $15,000 or $20,000?
Yeah. Through the chair, thank you for the question, Senator Bundy. It was a part of it was looking at what typical claims look like, as well as what would be a sustainable number for the fund to maintain, and $10,000 seemed to be that number.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions? We'll call Jerry McCune. And in the interests of, we have approximately five people to testify, so we'd like to please begin, Mr. McCune.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry McCune. I represent United Fishermen of Alaska. As you heard Jake say that, you know, this is a dedicated fund on program receipts that go to the Department of Revenue and then is administered by the Fishermen's Fund Board and the Department of Labor. The $10,000 is kind of a place to start at and see how much claims do come in if the bill were to pass, and see if how much tax would actually be on the fund. Even though it sounds like a lot of money, we all know that the $10,000 from the $2,500 was only worth $345 today from 1959. So it gives us a point to start at, look at, but also lets the fishermen and the health clinics know that they have $10,000 to work with, not $2,500. And you don't have, there is a appeal system to, you can appeal to the board and the department to get more funds, and they have to look at it all over. But this would give them, as he went in there, the emergency room, you know, $2,500 is hardly anything. And this gives them a little room, certainly for the fishermen and for the clinics and the hospitals, not to have to go to appeals and do a whole bunch of more paperwork, and we'll see how it works down in the future. So that's pretty much what I have, Mr. Chairman, and it will benefit all the fishermen across the state that pay into this. They pay up to 39% or $50 on a permit hold. On a permit holder pays up to $50, it's capped. A crewman would pay $23.40 out of their crew licenses. That comes from the Fisherman's Fund from the Department of Fish and Game. So that's where the funds come from directly, and it's about $1 million a year. And then you take out administrative costs out of that, whatever that ends up to be. The way I understand it, it's $307 per claim for the person to do the claim and the paperwork and the retirement and everything else that goes with that from the Department of Labor, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. McCune. Any questions, Senator Bundy?
Thank you. From the thrust of your comments, then, it seems as if this is a trial balloon, and if it doesn't negatively impact the account, you would likely then ask for a greater increase?
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, I would probably have to sit down with the board again and negotiate that numbers. I would look at, it used to be that there was a bigger amount coming from the permit holders, and it was I might have to look at a way to supplement the fund a little bit more if there is a big tax on it, but it was something that we looked at in the future, but you're absolutely correct. We want to take a couple years, take a look at it, and then let the department look and see how it is taxing the fund, if there's a lot of big claims coming in or too many more claims, and how much that would be taken out of the fund.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. McCune. Bob Thorstensen, I hope that's the correct pronunciation.
You nailed it.
Please identify yourself.
Chairman, and then, members of the committee, I'm Bob Thorstensen. I'm representing Alaska Same Boat Owners, and we're very much in favor of this bill. We feel a bit remiss in waiting so long to have raised it. Perhaps this should have gone up to 5,000 in the 70s and probably been bumped up to 10,000 at this point, but very much in favor of it. And I wanted to just point out a couple on-the-ground examples or on-the-water examples. Part of the reason for this, my appearance, I used to be a much more dashing young man, but I lost my front teeth with it when a big block hit me in the face out fishing. And it cost me out of pocket about $6,000 to get these fixed and have the periodontist and the dentist, and I negotiated with them. But it was a $2,500 cap, and then I dealt with the rest of it myself. I was able to do that because I've been fishing for 33 years, and I was able to have some savings. Had I been a young skipper and not had the opportunity to save money, it would have been a big financial burden to deal with that. And 5 years ago, this finger was severed and cut off completely, the last inch of it, and I got flown in to Sitka, and that was another $6,000, but Fisherman's Fund was able to help with $2,500, and so it made it less of a burden. But as a young skipper, new entrant in the business, and are perhaps less financially fortunate, that the $2,500 is obviously becoming more and more obsolete as far as a limit. I'd like to also state that we're working with the Department of Labor and with the Fisherman's Fund Board on some other regulatory changes and administrative changes to make this a better program. It's been a spectacular program. When you look around the state and you deal with workers' comp, and the state has expenses and issues that relate to many of the other industries, and in the commercial fishing industry, our independent commercial fishermen pay their own way 100%. There's no state push, there's no state involvement. You guys have been able to help with the state, helps us monitor these things in the Department of Labor, and we really appreciate that. But we're just looking to improve what is already a very positive thing and a very good thing with the workers' with our Fisherman's Fund Board and the Department of Labor, and just wanted to speak in support of this bill.
Thank you very much, Senator Bundy.
Thank you. As I understand it, your crew members say you spend most of your time in the pilot house drinking coffee. Maybe that's just to keep you from getting hurt?
Yeah, this was five years ago. It was the last year I was on deck, and I got this finger wrapped around the winch. And if it wouldn't have taken this finger off, you know, if I wasn't so had so much more body mass to slow me down, it probably would have taken more of the body. But I was fortunate; it was just a finger. But
you better stay in the pilot house. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You much, Thorstensen. Mr. Thank you very much. I believe the last person is Jim Herbert.
For the record, Jim Herbert, Seward, Alaska, commercial fisherman. I'd like to testify in support of this bill. I've been a commercial fisherman in the state since 1971 and have served on the Fisherman's Fund for 12 years. I'm intimately conversant with a lot of the claims that come across. I believe this is a very sage amendment to increase the basic limit for people. I think the essence of the program is fishermen helping fishermen. It's self-sustaining. I follow what Jerry has just said, that over time we may see some changes in either the revenues to the fund or the outlays to people, but given my experience with the fund, I think it will be within reason, and any changes will not be dramatic and overnight. There'll be enough time to react, to either raise the limits, as you suggested, or seek other sources of revenue. it doesn't take much to spend $2,500 in an emergency room, and there certainly are people who greatly benefit from the program. I support the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Mr. Herbert. Seeing no questions of Mr. Herbert, I know that there were two persons from the Department of Labor that they indicated questions only. Are there any, or anyone have any questions of either Mr. Monagle or Ms. Hikas? Seeing none, we will close public testimony on Senate Bill 163. Any discussion of the committee as to what we might do at this time? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion, Senator Thomas.
And I would move that that Senate Bill 163 version / A be moved to the next committee of referral with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Seeing no objections, it is so ordered. And on the 50th anniversary of this state, the change that's the first one since statehood is very appropriate, and I'm glad we could do this in our committee. So thank you to all the people that appeared and testified in support. This meeting is adjourned.